arrived here about 20 minutes ago, and there were a few people who had come into this room to reserve for themselves very good seats, but most people had gone into the other room to grab the tea while it was there. I'm glad to see that you've now filled up and are back here. So welcome to today's joint colloquium between Fields and the Physics Department. It's my pleasure to introduce today's speaker, Yun Zhang, who will speak on unidirectional flight of a flapping wing. Yun has his bachelor's degree in physics from Wuhan University in China. He studied in Israel before moving to the Niels Bohr Institute at the University of Copenhagen. I love to say Niels Bohr, it kind of rolls off the tongue, where he got a PhD in physics. He has been at NYU pretty much ever since, where he has a joint appointment in mathematics and in physics. He works in nonlinear dynamics, many aspects, which again is a field that unites mathematics and physics. And yesterday he spoke over at Fields on basically geophysical processes, a very large scale. Today he is going to talk about flapping wings at a completely different scale. I guess that's all in the day's work for you physicists. It's a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Wow. Never seen so many people this year, by the way. Okay. So today I'll be talking about something about locomotion of animals. Right? So I'll be targeting on flapping wings, something to do with the flapping locomotion of birds. But I will at some point touching swimming of fish. But first of all, I want to acknowledge my co-workers. Here, Lionel Rossellini, a visiting student from France, and a postdoc who worked with us a few years ago. Steve Childress, a professor at the Curran, and the rest of the group in year 2005. Okay. Yes, happy people in New York. So, okay, here I want to do. First of all, I want to try to do two demonstrations. If I throw this chalk like this, I give this problem to a student, giving the initial conditions, the speed, the angle, the rotation, someone can solve the problem in one afternoon, easy. But if I drop this guy touching the ground, that's a very difficult problem because you deal with the fluid, which is the air, and you deal with a shape-changing boundary. Okay, so what happens is, here the fluid is described by this Navier-Stokes equation. It's a nonlinear partial differential equation, which is hard to solve. But for the solid, you have F equals ma. It's very easy to deal with. When you have a deformable boundary, what we call it dynamic boundary, coupled to this equation, that's a nightmare because the pressure forces change the shape of this boundary, and then in return, this boundary will impose new boundary conditions to the fluid. And then this iteration will go on. It's almost impossible to do anything analytically. Simulation-wise, it's also extremely expensive. But this doesn't prevent us to do anything, say, experiment, or doesn't stop the fish swimming in water. Okay? They solve the problem quite easily. Okay? So here, if I put a fish in a lab in a water tunnel, and I switch on the motor, so there's a flow going this way, so the fish will immediately orient towards the current and try to swim to compensate the motion caused by the fluid. It's like I put anybody here on a treadmill, I switch the treadmill on, you have to walk immediately, okay? That's a basic reflex you have, okay? Judged mostly by your visual reference. So by biologists, they will call it something like optomotor behavior, okay? So this guy swims up. not always right in the middle of your water tank and allow you to take data, to photograph and smile. But sometimes this guy hides within the boundary layer where the flow is quite slow, or hides in a corner and get crushed by the current. Okay? The lazy fish. Or sometimes try to get out. Okay? Of course. Then this is a very difficult system for a naive physicist, someone like me. Okay? So the easy system for me to deal with probably is a dead fish. Okay? In the spirit of Halloween. So actually there's a scientific base for dealing with a dead fish. Say if I put a dead fish in a water tank and I flush water this way, if this guy starts to flap, I can somehow regard that's sort of my eigen mode. So any active motion, say executed by live fish, so if that one powers the muscle, try to swim up, I can somehow consider that's a sort of perturbation added to this kind of eigen mode. Okay? That's the line I put. Maybe active swimming or flying body, like a bird or fish, can somehow utilize the passive dynamics, the intrinsic passive dynamics shown in a dead system or powerless system. Okay? So that's the philosophy behind. That's why we went directly from a dead fish. We further reduced the complexity of a shape of a fish and narrowed it down further and further and keep the slender body and also keep the flexibility of the system. So here we arrive at a flag, okay? Basically a flapping flag. Right now I further induce the dimensionality to a thin silk, very short thread that is made of silk. The flow tunnel right now changes, also collapse into 2D, which is a flowing soap film. Okay. Soapy water we wash dishes with. Okay. Here I have a container, I have a nozzle controls the flux. Driven by gravity, this soap film comes down and arriving to this collector, otherwise we call it the wet lab. Okay. And here you fix at the tip of this silk thread and watch what happens. Actually, it does flap like a flapping flag. So that's the photo taken in the lab, okay? And to our surprise, we found there are two stable states. One is that the flag is pinned here, the rest is free, but it doesn't flap at all. It gets extended by the flow, okay? If you give a small kick here to the side, if the kick is small enough, this state is stable to small perturbations. But if the amplitude is big enough, if I kick it hard, it will jump to a stable flapping state and it will stay there. Okay. And also if I visualize the tip of this flapping flag, it executed this figure of eight motion within the 2D plane. It looks pretty much, if you have seen a swimming fish, it looks pretty much like the trajectory of the tail of the fish. So some numbers. Oops. So if I change the length of the flag or the speed, flow speed of the water tunnel, okay, so I will see one stable branch and another stable branch. And in between, I have a bistable window, meaning that I can either choose here or choose here. That's a huge hysteresis. Okay? The same thing, that's the same graph. If I change the length of the flag or the flow speed of the flag, you will see this amplitude. You have two values. Here's zero, non finite. Okay? What you see here, that's an interference pattern from the same film. Once, if you use a monochromatic light, like a low pressure sodium light, so you get a very sharp interference pattern. Basically visualizes the subtle change of the film thickness. The film here is about like a 2-3 micron thick. It flows at a speed like a few meters per second. Very impressive laminar flow tunnel. Cheapest water tunnel you can ever build. Okay? But it breaks all the time, of course. You have to solve that problem. So here I want to show you a movie of this bistability. Right now the flow goes this way. It depends on how I orient my camera. Okay? So before it was flapping, so I tried to use this screwdriver to stop it. So the system is turned off. Right? You have this kind of Van Karman vertex straight trailing off the free end. And then I can switch it on. So it depends on the order, the magnitude of this perturbation. Once you switch to another state, it will stay. Okay? That's within the bistable regime. Also, I want to show you some details. Basically the same movie, but taking with a high-speed video. So the flow goes this way. You have this very peculiar wake trailing off from the free end, okay, where vorticity is very concentrated within this narrow band. Okay. Looks like a part of the flag somehow. In fact, some of the simulations has been treating this flag itself as a massive concentrated vortex sheet. So I won't go too far here, but now I want to move to rigid bodies, to give you a reference. Here, in the same type of flowing soap film invented by Martin Rutgers some years ago, he stick into a glass cylinder, which is only 3 millimeters across. Okay? Here, you have this so-called classical Van Karman vertex street. Okay? You can find these kind of patterns on stamps some years ago. That means you should know them. Okay? So you see this eddies. So the scale is of millimeters. And if you happen to go out space, take a look at island called Guadalupe, I guess that's the way to pronounce it. That's America. Canada is up here. You have a gentle wind. You have the same kind of vortex shedding off from this island. The scale here, that's about 30 or 20 kilometers across. You basically get exactly the same kind of phenomena here. This is, again, a Van Karman strait. Okay. Now, after the pictures, let's get some numbers. So if I know the cylinder diameter here, and I know I can measure the shedding frequency of all these eddies, and I know the oncoming flow rate, the speed here, I can cook up a dimensionless number, okay, AF, that's has a dimension of speed, and U is the oncoming flow rate. This is dimensionless. For large range of Reynolds number, that means for low up to very high flow speed or different sizes across many, quite a few order of magnitude, this number, this Struhl number, stays very close to 0.2 for Van Karman. Very stable, okay, within 5%. Okay. If we move to fish, as we know it, when fish swims, or when the bird flies, they better push something backwards, like a rocket, to gain momentum to move in the direction they want to go. Okay. How do they do that? Only 10 years ago or so, there was the first simulation after using live fish. Okay? Live fish. Okay? So here you have a fish, the blue part is the tail, and you have these eddies shedding off from the tail. You have these alternating eddies, okay, occupying the space. That's the so-called PIV measurement, stands for Particle Imaging Velocimetry. It's kind of nice two-dimensional visualization method. But when you look closely, look into these alternating eddies, you will find the size of each eddy is a sort of complete opposite from the one we just saw for rigid bodies. Okay? For Van Karman strait, when you have flow going like this, you see eddy going like this, like this. When I pick up just two neighboring eddies, you will see this guy go like this, you have a little puff going towards pointing towards the solid body. What does that mean? It says that this guy slows down the flow after rigid body. Okay? You slow down the flow when you place a rigid body in the flow. But for fish, it's quite different. You also have this alternating eddies. When you pick up two neighboring eddies, you see there's a path going like this, going like this. Every time you have a push. Okay? It's like you walk, but you walk on continuous medium. Okay? So it's totally inverted. So that's why people call it inverted von Karman vertex street. So we will see this later at this talk. In terms of numbers, the Trent fellow brothers then at MIT, they plotted all the stroke numbers for swimming fish. So they plot out the A, the flapping amplitude, peak to peak flapping amplitude of the tail, and the flapping frequency. Here is the speed of their swimming speed. They found this number is pretty much concentrated around 0.3 instead of 0.2. So we are talking about 20% increase. Okay, they are doing something extra. Of course, the definition of amplitude can be discussed somehow. It's not the diameter of the body. Okay, we are talking about peak-to-peak amplitude here. And of course, you see some of the animals, they concentrate, they very physically collapse on 2.3, working quite hard. Some of them are quite playful. Okay, so different personality somehow. Okay, so that's for fish. And the title, if you remember, for this talk is about flapping wings. Okay, so between flapping, swimming, and the flying, the artists have intuitions. Okay, that's one of the woodcut by Escher. I guess you have this at some point. That's the first proof that swimming is somehow related to flying. Okay, if you're now convinced, that's the second proof. Okay. Anyway, you deal with Navier-Stokes equation, you have a flapping motion, so they are related. Very closely related, actually. So for birds, if you want to fly, you better stay in the air. You have to fight with your body weight. To do that, you better generate enough aerodynamic lift. Okay, these two forces better be equal. To do that, you need enough fast enough speed. In order to realize high speed, you need a thrust, because when you move in the air, and you experience resistance. So these two pairs of forces better balance with each other. I don't know how many people here have seen this movie, Wind Migration. Well, quite a lot. It's an art movie. It's a very nice documentary about flying birds, large birds. Okay. I have DVDs in case you want. And I watch them many times whenever I travel, not in the past few years. Maybe because I watch it for too many times, I start to have illusions. Okay? The illusions I had was, well, first of all, this is not quite an illusion. The flapping motion, as you can see, the birds, they flap their wings up and down, but they travel horizontal, perpendicular to the direction of flapping. The second thing is, there seems to be there's no pitching or rolling added to the flapping motion. Pitching is this, okay? So the birds, somehow they don't do this. They don't do anything complicated. When you see the movie, it looks as if those wings are somehow rigid. You just flap it, and as if you carve out something material, nearly the same shape and the same density, some weight, and you mount those wings for them, if they accept them, and they might be able to fly with it. Right? And so the wings seems to be rigid somehow. So we're not talking about the feathers at the very tip. We're talking about the entire wing for large birds. Okay? So here we are talking about flapping flight, and the biologists also have been looking into the origin of flight for many years, and there has been two schools. One school of biologists, they believe the so-called the theory from the ground up. Some birds, they happen to have these appendages, they flap, they struggle when they move from point A to point B. And at some point, they find that when you flap, it gives you some extra thrust for you to climb slopes, even vertically. At some point, they can sustain a forward motion in the air. Okay, that's one school. There's another school says from tree stump. It means some early birds happen to have a lot of feather, and they glide from high up, try to land, or they happen to fall. When they struggle, they find at some point they generate enough thrust, they can sustain, and they can stay in the air, and longer and longer. Okay? Then they realize for flapping flight. As physicists, I guess we are all physicists here, we can do probably two things. One thing is invent a time machine and travel back in time many, many millions of years ago, but we don't get the grant for that. Second thing, I guess, what we can do is to ask or to invent what is the simplest wing we can ever build that can generate a thrust and that can sustain a forward motion. Okay, what is the minimum simplest wing we can ever build? So I ask you to ask a baby. Ask a baby, so show me a wing that can fly. Okay. The baby comes back with this. Okay, that's it. That's one. Okay. So the question here is, can a simple, rigid, symmetric wing, if I flap it up and down, maybe this guy can, you know, by some miracle, can go sideways. The second question is, If it does fly, I would like to know if there's a threshold. Because at the low speed, when this viscous effect, dumping effect is dominant, this guy shouldn't go anywhere. Okay? The Navier-Stokes equation becomes linear. Okay? It's a reversible, time reversible. Okay? So here I want to show you a simulation. A PowerPoint simulation. Okay, so it's a big lie. So that's the dream we try to realize. So this flaps and it leaves. Okay. And then maybe we can do this. In a linear geometry, if you set up something, your serving system has to follow it, to drive it. Okay. So that's a little hard. So once we discussed with Steve Childress, with Nicola Vandenberg, we thought maybe we can do this kind of test in a rotational geometry. Basically, I have this. It won't fly, but I just show you the geometry. Okay, that's a board. This is a wood, piece of wood. Okay, I connect to the shaft like this. And here I have a bracket, I flap it up and down. But here and here, I have two very low friction ball bearings. That means when I flap it, this guy can rotate if it wants due to the interaction with the surrounding fluid. Here I have a tank filled with water, say. Okay? So I only control the up and down flapping motion. I do absolutely nothing to the horizontal motion of this wing. I want to see what happens. The flapping amplitude, A, I can control. I can control the frequency. I can control the fluid I put in here. And of course, I try to reduce the friction here as much as I can to my best. Okay, that's first generation for the flapper. And that's Terminator 2. You see too much movie, I guess. And somewhere here, I send a sheet of light, laser sheet. I view it 90 degrees, try to visualize what is going on, you know, around this flapping wing. So here's a movie I want to show you. When I increase the flapping frequency, what happens? In the background, what you see is a shaft. It's a little blurred. What you are looking at is something like this. I send a light crossing here. That's a visualization. I try low frequency first. Nothing happens. It doesn't go anywhere. We try to change, increase the flapping frequency while keeping the amplitude constant. Then at some point, maybe, it decides to do something, to leave the original place. It starts to run, and it won't stop. If you agree with me, that means, say here, the segment here moves this way, this segment here moves this way. I can call each part of this is moving at a linear speed. I would call it forward flight, if you agree with me. Okay? So I would say the system started out from very symmetric setting and it lost its stability to a forward rotational motion. So we call it forward flight. Okay. Of course, initially the system was symmetric. We have this so-called spontaneous symmetry breaking. Once it pick up one direction, it will persist and it goes. Basically, we have half and a half probability to go either direction. Okay. And here's some time series of this motion. Here is how many driving period I have. So you start out from here, say if I run at a low frequency, it will stay quiet. At some point, it jumps off. It will start forward. Unidirectional rotation. The next trial will take a little longer, and the next trial will pick up another direction. And if I increase the frequency to almost twice, so you see this guy takes much shorter time to reach this terminal speed. And the speed itself is higher than the previous one. Okay? I will show you that the forward speed is linearly proportional to the flapping frequency. So you have a distribution of the waiting period. Okay? Depends on, you know, it's like, again, I will speak about this over and over. It's like a smooth marble sitting on a smooth hill like this. Okay? It takes time, different time for this guy, starting out from a symmetric position and then fall off this way. So it's very sensitive to the initial condition. That's why you have a distribution of this waiting time. Okay. Here, we have a flapping frequency. That's angular speed. And you can easily multiply this quantity by the length of this guy and you get a linear speed of each element on the way. So you have a linear relationship. And here, you see there's a threshold, something around 500 or so, below which you don't have any forward motion. And then you jump to this branch. When you come down from this unidirectional motion, it overshoots at the lower Reynolds number, and then come back like this. Okay, you have a hysteresis. So in dynamical system, we call it a subcritical bifurcation. Okay. But this might due to the finite friction imposed on the shaft. If you have a strong friction, probably this onset will be delayed also. Okay, here's some numbers we should define. For the vertical motion, I can define the so-called Reynolds number. Right? Reynolds number is speed times the length, normalized by viscosity. Okay, it's dimensionless number. The speed is flapping amplitude multiplied by the frequency. That gives you the dimension of speed. That's the average speed for the vertical one. So that looks like this. If it rotates on the horizontal plane, so you can define another Reynolds number, that you can get that by balancing the inertial torque when this guy replacing the fluid, okay, in one direction, and normalized by the viscous damping torque applied on the skin of this guy. When you balance this guy, what I want to tell you is that you get a coefficient 3/4 out. That means for the entire length, for the entire wing, if I want to choose a representative point to say what is the linear speed of my system, I shouldn't pick up anywhere here. That's zero. Here, the tip of the wing, the speed is too high. Somewhere here, 3/4. That's, through this dimensional analysis, I get this number. That's the place I want to do my speed measurement. I want to do flow visualization. Okay. So at low Reynolds number, when the speed is low or when the frequency is low, what happens is when I pull this guy up, you create two eddies on both sides. Okay. And then when I change direction, flapping it down, these two eddies disappears due to viscous damping, okay? Because the speed is too low. They get dissipated. And then you create new eddies on the other side. But if you have a higher frequency or higher Reynolds number, that's another video I want to show you. You see these nice eddies? Okay. In the background, you have the shaft that flaps around. That's on another side of the wing. Okay. That's a still picture taken by a digital camera. Of course, we took thousands of pictures. When we submit the paper, we say that's a typical visualization. Of course, that's the best, right? And then when you check the direction of each eddy, you see this. That's the inverted Van Karman. As I said, the way to judge it, when you check a pair of these vertices, you form a dipole. That you have a puff, puff, puff. You push every time when you flap. Okay, when I check the so-called stronghold number, from this graph, I can check the flapping amplitude multiplied by the frequency of flapping, normalized by the forward speed. I got something around 0.3, actually precisely 0.27. Right? Here, I have a wing that has no load. So when the number is slightly lower than 0.3, that means you swim a little faster than those birds or fish. Okay. That also says the forward speed is about 3 times the speed of vertical flapping. Okay, so how about the instability? And why it takes off at the first place? We want to look into that. Just look at roughly the mechanism. I said when this wing moves up on the two edges, you create these two eddies. When you move down, they disappear. That only happens at low Reynolds number. At high enough Reynolds number, when you move up, you create these two guys. When you move down again, they are still there. Okay? If they are still there, there's something interesting going on. You have an eddy going like this, eddy going like this. This eddy will create a viscous force, try to pull this wing to this direction. And this guy will try to put this direction. Imagine if you have a tiny offset from the geometric center, say this way. So you are losing part of the area to this guy, you gain some of the area to this guy. So correspond to this situation. If you write down a simple model, you have F equals the displacement to a positive coefficient. So you have a potential look like this. You have to fall, either this way or that way. So that's why you break the symmetry at the first place. Okay. Spontaneous symmetry breaking. When you start to gain some speed, say you have a largely vertical motion, say in this cartoon, you have just a little bit of the forward motion. Now we are talking about amplification from low speed to high speed. That's a little bit of fluid dynamics. So that's the eddy you have from previous stroke you are crashing onto. The other one already somehow escaped to this trailing eddy of the new of the motion when you come down. So right now you are creating a trailing edge vertex and you have a leading edge vertex. When you check viscous friction, so you have this area that will help you to further push the wing going this direction. And you have a leading edge vertex will also exert a viscous force, try to push the wing this way. There's another force called leading edge vertex pressure suction, meaning that when we talk about eddy in a fluid, right in the center of each eddy, you have a pressure depression. When you walk away from the center, you slowly recover that pressure. Okay? So that means here you have a pressure low, but here this part of the surface is near to this low. So you have low pressure experienced by this part of the wing. And here the entire wing is quite far away from this low pressure. So you have a pressure difference. This guy, the pressure field somehow sucks the wing to this direction. You have a component that way. So that causes further amplification. Right now, it's late. Okay. So you move even faster. At some point, it will saturate. What is the point? Now I reverse direction, okay? I should change this figure, make it more consistent. So that's one instant when I flap downwards and also move flying forward like this, I have an instantaneous speed going like this. Okay? You see right now I have a forward speed much greater than the vertical direction. Okay? So I can dissect this one to the forward and downwards. For a flat wing going like this, I have an angle of attack here. So if I move like this, I have a lift generated due to this angle of attack, which is perpendicular to this dashed line. The dashed line is instantaneous speed. Okay? So this guy, this lift, have a horizontal component. That's the thrust generated for the wing to move forward. When I balance this guy with the resistance experienced by the wing, I settle my wing at that single speed. End of the game. Okay. So that's the situation where the saturation comes in. So actually, with this, you can do some dimensional analysis. Okay. But I will leave the picture. Or we come to the second question I asked some time ago. What is the threshold for Reynolds number? Because below certain Reynolds number, the viscous damping is so big, nothing will happen. I won't have forward flight. So I should look at this graph again. Okay, this is a flapping frequency, that's a rotational speed. Here I have this threshold around 400 or something, okay, in water. So if I extrapolate backwards this line, I get a threshold here. Okay, I call it apparent threshold, REF0. And we do suspect that this delay, say this hysteresis, also this onset, is somehow due to the finite friction on the shaft. Okay? So what I'm going to do is, if I increase the viscosity of the fluid, I can increase the forces between the flapping wing and the surrounding fluid, okay, while maintaining the same Reynolds number. When all the forces, interacting forces between this structure and the surrounding fluid increases, effectively the weight, the resisting force acting on the shaft will be somehow diluted. Okay? At least I can increase this, the viscosity of this fluid in steps. Higher, higher, even higher. So the influence due to the shaft, I hope, will become smaller, smaller, and smaller. That's a hope. Indeed, when I redo the experiment, here's the original data somewhere lying somewhere here, water, I start to add glycerol and makes the fluid more viscous. And when the viscosity is like three times the water of water, I get a new line parallel to the original one. Started out from here, I get a smaller onset. And then if I increase the viscosity further, I get smaller and smaller onset for Reynolds number. So I can do a backward extrapolation. That's for water, for higher viscosity, even higher, I can do a backwards extrapolation. I can find the Reynolds number is in the order of 20 to 50. For people who care about fluid dynamics, that's the number tells you the onset, the threshold of this flapping motion. And also, we can change geometry of this wing. There's not too much geometry to talk about here, okay? But we have thickness, we have the chord C here, and we have the length, and so on. So in the measurement, for example, here, that's my frequency, that's my angular speed of the rotation, I get this one. Okay? So between the frequency, that's my threshold, I have a coefficient before I get the rotational speed. So I'm going to concentrate on this guy, right? The slope, basically, when I change the geometry, say the thickness. So, say, if I increase the chord, the width of this wing, you will find if I increase that, the forward speed will increase. Each time I get a straight line. Okay? We get different slope. So this slope will change slowly. Looks like there's a saturation. Also, I can change the length. This length of this guy. Okay. So you can see if I increase the length, the slope gets slower, slower. Smaller, smaller. Why? As we know it, the forward speed is locked with the vertical speed. You have this Strouhal number, which is almost fixed. Okay, so when you increase the length of the wing, while keeping somewhere on the wing, have the same factor of the speed of your flapping speed, so you better the angular speed better slow down. So that's why you have a tendency that looks like this, like 1 over L or something like that. Now you can change the amplitude of flapping and change the thickness. We have only two dots here. Then you can do a data collapse. Here is the dimensionless number. That's the flapping amplitude. That's the length. That's the chord. That's the thickness. And here's the coefficient. So you get a straight line here. And we do have a dimensionless analysis based on the force diagram I showed you a few minutes ago. We have a theory to explain why this guy has to be linear with this. But today I have to skip this. But I want to ask, what else what more can we learn in the lab about flapping flight? Okay. So for the moment, we are targeting several things. Say the ground effect. You know, many birds or fish, they like to swim or fly near a solid boundary, not too far from that. How about flexibility? The wings and the tails are flexible. They certainly play a role, hopefully a very positive role. And also the effect of the stroke form. You don't expect the bird to follow exactly this sine wave. They probably do something like that. Okay? I did well. I did, becoming better and better. And then schooling of fish and all that. So the boundary effect, for example, this photo, you can see the reflection from water, from the lake. We do find near when the gap between the body to the surface, when you change, you normalize by the flapping amplitude, there's a bump here. You gain like a 15% of speed. So there's a ground effect. We try to understand it. Also, you can build a wing. You break the symmetry. You put a rubber here. This part is a stainless steel. That's a rubber. So when you go like this, we call it forward. When you go like this, we call it backward. Okay? So for the backward motion, started out as the same as the forward motion, and then they start to show some difference. Okay? So with the rubber takes the lead, you have something like this. At some point, at this point, the whole system becomes unstable, will drop to zero and then flick to the upper branch. Actually, this one, this branch, corresponds to a much faster, say 20% faster than a rigid wing. The rigid wing will be somewhere here. Okay? Correspond to this line. Also, right now we are working with a group by John Roberts and Ross Tedrick, the computer scientist and engineering department. We are modifying the stroke form and validate if such stroke form will increase the speed or decrease the speed. So we dissect this waveform into many points. We shift individual points and try to evolve this stroke form until we get very high speed. Okay? So there's a lot of nice things you can do. Also, we try to learn what's going on. You know, we observe fish, they form schools, and the birds, they form flocks, and there should be a reason for that, not only sociological reason. They want to be together like us. Okay? So there must be some reason. So this summer, I've been working on this with a student, visiting student, Life Restroff from Cornell. But I want to show you a movie. I'm finishing quite soon, I think. Okay, the flow is going this way. I'm using a strobe light to visualize what's going on. And, okay. Let me. So here I have six flags, you know. It's an amusement park. Six flags. You got this. Strobe light. The frequency, by the way, is on the order of 50 or 60. Okay. So with the strobe, you can basically slow down the motion. Okay. They flap at the same frequency. We are looking into the forces exerted by the flow on each of the flag, which is a very difficult job. So, okay, so what I will, right now I think it's time to conclude. I think some conclusions we can draw from this simple, maybe you can call it stupid setup, okay, the geometry like this, doesn't look like a wing. There's a spontaneous symmetry breaking that can lead to forward flight. At least it can. So the bird doesn't have to use it, but it's there if you need. Okay? The flight performance is sensitive. It depends on the geometry. And from the relationship I showed you the last couple of slides, the coefficient and dimensionless geometry, you can translate that into Struhle number. You see that that goes with it's a function of chord and thickness. So it's a variable, it's not constant. Now the question is, why in nature we observe somehow a constant? The answer right now we have is that because we, so far we only care about thrust generation. We haven't looked into the energy cost. We haven't talked about the lift generation, which is needed for birds. And those issues has to be taken into account. So it might be for other chord lengths that give you higher speed might be too costly. Okay? So yet we have questions like that, quite a few. So what is the optimal flapping amplitude? We don't quite know. For example, for a wing like this, you probably don't want to flap it like this. Okay? And you don't observe that in nature. It flaps nearly around the length scale you have. And what is the lowest possible Struhle number? Basically, I ask you, what is the highest speed you can ever reach with a wing? So we are doing flexible wings, partially flexible wings, or we allow the wings to pitch right now, so try to answer this question. And what type, as physicists, we care what type of bifurcation we are dealing with. From the experiment, looks like we have a subcritical bifurcation, but from numerical simulations, and people have shown this might be a supercritical bifurcation. Okay? So the subcritical bifurcation might be imposed somehow by the resistance of the setup of the experiment. That's a downside. And the fourth generation we haven't looked into, also lift generation we want to study. So there's a lot of things we want to move into. And here's a list of papers. I want to thank you very much. No, we haven't. We look at when the speed is basically saturated, we look at the final speed, basically, so far. That would be interesting to look at. We have two walls coming down like this, up and down. So this guy is sitting right in the middle. In the genetics, right now, we are trying to study. For example, the past few months, we mounted a force sensor. We can measure how much work has been done to this vertical direction. And we can control the flat, the stroke form of this thing. If you ask a Trenta fellow at MIT who study Robert Turner, who builds a robotic swimming machine, he will tell you flapping is more efficient than propellers. The efficiency for average propeller is about 40% up to 50% or so. But for flapping wings, you can go up to 70-80%. So we have to look into the numbers and make sure the calculation is correct. So right now I don't have an answer. But I hope flapping is more efficient. So that's why we can.
So even if it is true, would there be a reason to expect that to scale up to high velocities, or could it be that it's more efficient at fish velocities but not at airplane velocities, or something like that?
Yeah, I don't quite know the answer to that. But the people have trying to build these flapping airplanes, ornithopters. I guess due to material constraint, so far this hasn't been much success. Right. 14 seconds. There was a thruster mounted to the back also to jump start the, right. So it's a little hard to tell within this 14 seconds. You know, I would love to see the machine at some point. In the end, it was blown off, it was tilted on the runway, so. Right. This guy is symmetric, right? So if I bring an airfoil, it will certainly will give you a directionality to the problem. So this one is up, down, and a four after the symmetric. Oh. Right. 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 That's true. Also, the flexibility also tells you the leading edge is far more rigid. You have bones, the massive muscles. The trailing edge, you have soft feathers and things like this, I guess. That's why they fly forward, I guess. So they say, some say flies, sometimes they fly backwards. I haven't seen that. Okay.
Yes, how much of this would apply? Hummingbirds seem to have a completely different motion.
That's hovering. Hummingbird does something completely different. It does this. The pitching and rolling is the most essential part.
Okay,
it does this. Right.
My swimming instructor told me that pitching
right.
is very important.
Right. Because we have cylinders, we don't have wings, I guess. The legs. We have four cylinders we work with. I'm a terrible swimmer myself, so I think that's why I'm studying this. Personal motivation.